Hello there, and welcome to the Tunes from Dublin podcast, an Irish traditional music interview series presented by myself, Charles Mono, and featuring guests from County Clare and beyond who come and visit us here in Dublin. On each episode of the show, we are guided by tunes picked and played by our guests, and we talk about various topics related to traditional music, such as sources of inspiration, repertoire, style, memories, and much, much more. If you'd like to support this podcast and the Tunes from Dublin project in general, you can head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/tunesfromdublin, where you can sign up and choose a support level that you can sustain. It doesn't have to be much. Even a cup of coffee per month really goes a long way. The link is in the show notes. Thank you so much for your support. Our guest for this episode is Eugene Lamb, musician and pipe maker with strong ties to Dublin and now based in Kinvara. Eugene knew all the Russells and other local musicians, and he did amazing work recording them. Hope you enjoy the tunes and chat, and make sure to stick around till the end to know more about Eugene, his story, and his music. Enjoy. Great tunes. Thank you, Eugene.
You're welcome.
It's great. So we're recording this episode here at my house in Dublin. We've been talking for a good while before recording because you've been teaching me some tunes. But what are those two tunes you just played?
Well, the first one, I didn't mean to go into that first one. I meant to go into another one called McGuire's Kick, but it starts off similar. I think I ended up playing the Rosinda Heather. And the second one was a tune from Fermanagh. I got from a mighty flute player called Gary Hastings. It's called the Maho Snaps. Now, it's a funny name because Maho, I didn't know, is a place name in Fermanagh, and the snaps are a local term for potholes in the road or bumps. So that's where the name comes from.
Nice. I learned that tune from Terry Bingham, who is also a big name on the Dublin scene, who is also in Kinvara these days.
I see. Yeah.
Funny that you started with this tune.
Yeah.
So for our listeners who might not know who you are, Eugene, you spent a lot of time in Dublin, but you're not from Dublin originally. Do you want to tell us about where you're from and how you discovered Dublin?
Okay. I was born in North County Dublin. It was a small village at the time. It's almost part of the city now. It's a place called Malahide, about 10 miles from the city. And I was born in a house and there were two fiddles in the house and there were books of music called the Kerr's manuscripts. There weren't a lot of music books around those days. And I was aware of music. My mother played the fiddle a little bit, but like most women of her generation, when they had the family days, they gave up. But they would have gone to sort of music classes and learned stuff like, I remember her playing that little tune called the Keel Row on the fiddle as a kid. Would have got from sort of Scottish traditional. You very seldom hear traditional Irish music at that time on the radios or anything. It was sort of, in a way, it was frowned on as sort of backward music. But I was lucky enough when I went to national school, there was a school teacher there. And on a Friday, he used to take a tin whistle out of his drawer and played a few tunes for us between 3:15 and 3:30. And I looked forward to that time. And eventually, he said if any of us wanted to get whistles, that he'd teach us a few tunes. Mm-hmm. So we got the old Clark sea whistles, like the one Mike Owen. A lot of the people used to play Clark's sea whistles, and the fiddles would be tuned down to the sea whistles. And I learned on that a few, little marches, first of all, and simple little stuff. Three of us got together in the school and used to play together in a little tin whistle band. This, when we were 9 or 10 or 11, we used to have little concerts in the towns and we'd play at those. We got sandpaper and we took all the paint off the whistles and made them gleaming silver and polished them up for the concerts. And we were very classy.
What year was that, roughly?
That was 1950, say the 55 or something.
In the mid-50s, yeah.
But then I joined a pipe band in Malahide. And one of the lads that used to come out to teach the pipe band, I was chatting to him one day and I had heard Illan Pipes on the radio. Leo Rosam used to broadcast sometimes, and I asked him about these. I'd never seen a set of Illan pipes, and he told me about a man up in Cabra that was making them, Dan O'Dowd, but Matt Kiernan. And I made my way up to Matt, and Matt was a lovely man, a retired policeman. He came from County Meath, a place called Baliver, and he was in the police force. He told me a very funny story when he was in the police force. He was a very big man when I met him. He was in his 80s. And he was well over 6 feet, but he must have been very big when he was young and active. And he was outside the GPO in Dublin, and he heard this piper playing, and it was Johnny Dorden busking in the street. And Matt, being a guard, couldn't talk to a traveller, but he was hiding behind the pillars trying to listen to Johnny's playing. And Johnny saw his uniform and he got a fright, and he packed his pipes up and went way up past Trinity College up to Thomas Street. And he set up there, and he wasn't halfway into his first tune. He looked up, and there was the guard, and Matt was following him around Dublin trying to learn tunes from him, but couldn't talk to him.
I actually didn't know guards couldn't actually interact with travellers, or what was the?
No, there was sort of class distinction. Really, they were looked down as sort of not quite up to the.
Yeah, but just for. Police officers to not even talk to them, that's
no,
crazy.
No, because they'd be fraternising with the enemy almost, you know.
Yeah.
And there was one time that Brendan Brannock, who wrote the Ciolán na hÉireann, a great scholar of Irish music, was judging a competition. And there was Felix Dorden, who was Johnny's brother, was in the competition. And there was a man called Michael Pagin from up around Monaghan somewhere. And he gave Felix Dorden the first prize, and he gave Michael Pagin second prize. There's only two of them in it. And Michael was really angry. He said, it's disgraceful. He said, a bank manager, because that's what he worked at, getting second place to a tinker. So it was that sort of class distinction. He never talked to Brendan Brannock after that. He wouldn't even refer to him as his proper name. He'd call him that old Brendan Welsh. That was the sort of the Irish.
Yeah. Anglicised, yeah.
So there was that sort of tension, yeah. But Johnny was reportedly to be a wonderful musician, and Matt loved his music. So that's where I got involved in the Illan pipes, and I went to him and saw him working in his workshop and got stimulated to make pipes myself.
So were you a teenager, young adult?
Teenager, yeah. I was actually just finished in school and getting ready to go into college when I would have met Matt. So that was 19... It's funny. So it's 62 or 63. It was great music in Dublin that time. There was a place in Thomas Street called the Piper's Club. It was always the precursor of Coulterlin. where people from the country used to gather on a Saturday night, and they'd play music. All the musicians that were in Dublin would gather in there. And I remember Lee Moog as a young piper playing there one night. And Leo Rosam used to teach upstairs. And John McKenna used to go to Leo and Lee Moog. I wasn't playing pipes at that stage. I just had playing the whistle. I used to go in from Malahide on my bike. And the way home then, we were fairly handy on bikes. We'd ride 10 miles home without the hands on the handlebars with the whistle, with the top of the whistle turned back way so the wind wouldn't take the notes away.
Yes.
And I remember the night I went in without it and I brought it back with me, the silver spear. And that was a wonderful. And I learned it on the bike that night, you know, with the whistle turned backwards.
Yeah.
There's no tape recorder, sir.
It's great memory. It must have been buzzing.
Oh, buzzing, yeah. It was really exciting to get a new tune. And, you know, things weren't available. You know, we didn't have any sort of electronic devices or anything those days.
So, yeah, you got going. And did you know from the get-go that you would have been interested in making Illan pipes?
I was always interested, as a kid, I was interested in making things. So when I saw them, especially when I saw Matt working in his back kitchen, he was a small little, what's called a scullery. He had a kitchen and he had a little shed off the kitchen. And that's where he had his couple of little lathes. He had a little lathe with a motor in it that he used for drilling the timber. But the main lathe he used was a treadle lathe, like a sewing machine with a foot controlled thing with a big flywheel. And that changed my attitude. I thought you'd have to get things in shops up till then. And all of a sudden it sort of twigged. Oh, yes, these things are made in people's houses. So it did. It was like an epiphany. I had made a guitar before that. Yeah, but the idea of making pipes really appealed to me. So I visited Matt very often. Now, we had great nights up there. Andy Conroy from Castlereagh would be there. And the stories in front of the range were as good as the playing. I still remember those times very, very fondly.
And then at some stage you moved west. What happened
was when I graduated from college, I got a job in England. I graduated with a PhD in biology, and I got a job in England in the fisheries laboratory in Lowestoft in East Anglia, about 100 miles north of London. And it was like a cultural desert there, really. There was no Irish music, there was no Irish people, really. And I was the only Irishman I worked in a laboratory as a scientist, and I was the only Irishman there, I suppose. So I was sort of missed the cultural thing. And I was there for a few years, and then I was in the civil service. I was very restrictive and I didn't like it much. So I left that and I went out onto the oil rigs in the North Sea because I'd been doing some diving. I was always diving as a kid. I loved being underwater. And when I was working as a scientist, they insisted that I went off and did proper diving training. They wanted me to become a navy dockyard for a month, called HMS Rosyth. And I was trained as a Royal Navy diver with using air hoses and stuff, so commercial diving. So because I had that training, I decided to give up the civil service and went out to the oil rigs as a rig diver. And I had a wonderful time out there, challenging job in bad conditions sometimes, but did lots of interesting jobs underwater, underwater welding and underwater cutting, put joining pipelines up and decompressing and all that sort of stuff.
It's funny, we've talked many times, but I actually never got that part about the oil rings, but I'm sure we'll get to talk about your adventures on water probably later. But so you're still in the North Sea at that stage. So when did the move west happen?
What made me think about that was I had to tell you how I became west, because one day on the oil rig, I got a radio call. There were no phones or anything from the university in Galway to say that there was a post there. They knew me from my time in the college, and they must have liked me because they asked me would I come and join the team. And there was a new department being set up. It's very active now. It's called the Marine Institute, and it was the early days of that, and they wanted me to come over and be part of it. And because I missed the culture, I decided that I would come back, and I took that job.
OK, You didn't think it over too much.
I just jumped at the idea. Because I knew I'd be over in the west of Ireland, and I'd be close to musical stuff and culture. But before that, as a student, I forgot to say that I had come down here on a field trip when I was in my fourth year in college. There was about 12 of us in the class. It was an honours stream in the Bachelor of Science degree, and we came down here on a field trip with a Jesuit priest. He was a wonderful character. He died only a few years ago. He was from Ballyhaunis in Mayo. And he was a very, very good scientist. And he led us down. And, we were doing some work on the geology and the botany and of the Burren.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up one night after. We were stayed in Ballinalecken Castle. And we went down to O'Connor's in Fisher Street when it was a small pub. And I thought it was like heaven. All the lads were there. Mike Owen, Packy and Gussie and Willie Begg and Michael Sherlock. Stevie Mac on the Bowron, and I thought it was wonderful. Packy, I had a whistle and I played Carolyn's concerto for Packy, and Packy thought it was a wonderful tune. He never heard it before, and he was at me all night long trying to learn it. And so it was lovely that time and quiet. And I sort of made a decision that if I get half a chance, I'll come back to Ireland, back down around here. And that's how I ended up jumping at the job in Galway, and I used to come down to Doolin pretty regularly then and met all the old characters.
Yeah, of course. And so that first trip that you took when you were on that field trip, late 60s, early 70s?
That was 67.
Okay, yeah, so that was before the whole revival and sort of the first few tourists were there. It would have been...
It was, but it was sort of starting then because people were, people were aware of Doolin as being a special place and a place with an unbroken sort of thread to the old music.
Uh-huh.
So the word was out, and the Flacules had started in the late 50s, I think, and people would have been aware of Doolin. There was a little bit of traffic coming.
Yeah.
Michael Cody arrived down around that time, just about it too, and fell madly in love with Packy. And wrote lovely poetry. And I often think about what caught Michael was he went into McDermott's pub. Michael was playing with a band in Listunvarna. I think he was playing drums. And Michael Cody, yeah.
Oh, I never knew he actually played in a band.
Playing with a dance band, yeah. And he came down to Doolin to get a break from the spa. We know what that feels like, to get away from the spa in September. And he just went into McDermott's, and who was sitting at the counter? Only Packy. And he went up to the counter to order a drink, and Packy turned him. Young man, he said, have you ever seen anybody playing a feather? Have you ever seen anybody playing a fiddle with a swan's feather? And of course, that was like gold dust to Michael Cody. It is a man talking in sort of wild, poetic language.
Yeah.
And they formed a relationship that lasted until Packy's death as a result of that just chance meeting. So people like that were coming in and seeing how unusual, it was in a way, Doolin.
Yeah.
It was like something that was sort of rare in other parts of the country.
And were you aware of that at the time of this first field trip?
I was, really. I was stricken, really, by the generosity of Gus and Dahl and the way they liked. Because I came from Dublin, where if you played a tune in a pub, you'd be thrown out, Because... tunes would lead to singing, and then singing would lead to somebody saying stop that noise and to be a row, and there was actually notices up in Dublin, no music, no, you'd be out. Even in Galway, I remember there was a very good musician who was still alive, a box player, who was only in his, he had won some competition, probably a Flacule, and his father brought him into a pub in Galway where he knew the man really well, and they were having a sort of I think it was confirmation or something. The whole family was there. And he asked the man politely in Galway, who owned a pub in Foster Street, is it okay if my son plays a tune? And the man who owned the place said, yes, he said, but only one.
Mm.
He didn't want any more than that.
Yeah, how things have changed.
How things have changed, yeah.
Good.
So I came from that sort of attitude to Doolin, where it was accepted, loved, and, looked up to. So it was a sort of a big thing.
Yeah. I've heard you telling the story before. I don't know if it was that first field trip, but about Packy playing that tune, the priest in his boots.
Oh, yeah.
Was that first?
That was one of those moments, too. We trooped in from being in the field all day long, muck. I think we had gone into, we had that same day gone into the cave now that's open, the one with the big stalactite. And the only way in there was you had to crawl through a long, tight passage on your belly through the muck. So we weren't well dressed or anything. And the priest wasn't really well dressed either. He had a big pair of hobnail boots on him. And I went up Patty had just finished the fireplace at the time, I think, and he was playing there, and the rest of the lads were playing around him. And I could see him looking at us. And after a while, he played that tune, and I asked him what it was, as I didn't know it. I'd never heard it before. And he had spotted the Jesuit with the hobnail shoes on him. And he smiled from ear to ear, and he said, "That's called the priest in his boots." I'll play the tune now.
Nice.
I can remember it.
Such a nice little tune. And when you tell the story, I can actually picture Packy's big smile. So for people who might not have seen pictures or videos or who didn't know Packy Russell, go and have a look, because he really has this huge smile, didn't
he? Yeah.
Great. So then let's go back to when you moved to Galway, got the job at the Marine Institute. Did you start making pipes around that time, or?
No, I had been making pipes when I was in the college, because I had access to a small little workshop there, and there were some benches that were used for chemical work, and they were made from very fine timber called Burmese teak, and they were throwing those out, and I cut those up, and I started working in the little workshop in the college. When I had done my bits of studying, I'd go down there and I'd start working on making the chanters and things. And I'd go back to Matt with them. Matt was my mentor, really. And then he'd examine them. And, you know, he was very helpful and very uncritical. And he paid me a great compliment once. I had made one and I had it working fairly nicely. And he asked me, could he have a loan of it? He wanted to measure it. And I thought that was lovely. Nowadays, people are always full of their own importance and think they know everything. But there was Matt that was old and making pipes for a long time, and he was admired in my work. And I don't know, you know, wasn't anyway great, but he wanted to measure it. He wanted to have.
Yeah.
He kept all the measurements in little books.
And there was something he liked about it.
Something he liked about it. Yeah. And he was. Yeah. So I always remember that.
Okay.
So I was, and then I went to England, and even when I was in England, even though I only had a little rented house in a place called Lowestoft, I had a little lathe there that I picked up, and I was making pipes there as well.
Okay.
And when I got back to, it was always a big part in my life, really. I went back to Galway, I had a little workshop there. But then I made the big move when I decided to leave the academic life, and I bought the old schoolhouse in Fenora and set up a proper workshop there and put a few good machines in.
So there was, what, at least 10 years between your first visit to Doolin and the time you actually came to settle in Fenor?
It was 79, I think, when I came to Fenor. Yeah, about 10 years, yeah.
But it was, you always felt...
But I always had come up and down from Galway to Doolin as well.
Yeah.
You know, and it also brought students. When I was teaching in Galway. I'd be bringing field trips down here,
mm-hmm.
and we'd be staying different places with them.
We talk a lot about Doolin, but like you really, it was the whole of North Clare that was, that you loved.
Yeah, we did a lot of tramping around the hills and valleys here and looking for rare plants and, you know, trying to figure out what water courses are. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, yeah, then I suppose when you're the strong link with Doolin and North Clare happened once you moved to Fionnuala and set up your workshop there. We talk a bit about your pipe making, but were you also learning to play them?
Yeah.
How did you go about, were you self-taught?
More or less, yeah. I did call to, there was a little place in Dublin called, I think it was called the Municipal College of Music. It was in a place called Chatham Street off Grafton Street, where Leo Russell was teaching the pipes. And I went up there. I had the practice set that I bought from Matt, and I went up to Leo to try and, you know, do a few lessons with him. But it was sometime in the spring, and he was almost finished the course for that year. I remember Paddy Maloney was in the class when I looked in. Afterwards, I recognised Paddy, who was famous in the Chieftains and eventually. But he wouldn't take me on because it was too near the end of the course. He said, "Come back in September and." But at that stage in September, I had actually learned how to, you know, play them, and I got Leo's tutor to make sure I had the right fingering, and just watch people. And when I used to go to the Piper's Club, like I said, Liam O'Flynn would be there, and Joe McKenna, and watch. They were a little bit ahead of me now, so I watch the way they were playing, and mm-hmm. so I go back and try it out. It was very much trial and error. The idea of getting classes wasn't around that time.
Mm-hmm.
Not for most of us anyway. So from then on, I'm sorry I didn't actually, you know, get going with classes with Leo, but, you know, that didn't happen that way.
Yeah, well, I don't think...
I moved away then soon after that, so I missed it, yeah.
Yeah, even if you didn't have the classes, you're still playing. And when you came to Doolin in North Clare, who were the people you got to play with at the time?
Well, when I came down to work in Fionnuala, In Fionnuala itself, there was a man called Mick Lennan who lived up the Cahir Valley, just where the road splits there, near the source of the Cahir River. And Mick played the whistle. So, and John Joe, his brother, it was Mick, John Joe, and his wife lived in the house together. So I used to go up there and we'd sit down and chat, and they'd tell stories about the bog. And, you know, there was a great tradition of storytelling around Fionnuala that time. We'd sit down and we'd play tunes, and John Joe would play the spoons. And then Mick would come down to me whenever he was going down to the shop. He'd call into the workshop. So I had a sort of rule in the workshop that if any musician came in, the work would stop. And I had musicians, like I had Michel Bonamy working with me. I think Michel was with me for nearly 2 or 3 years. Johnny Burke from Bray used to come down every so often and work with me. He just liked hanging around and we'd share ideas. Johnny was a very fine pipe maker himself. And Dan O'Dowd from Dublin would come down. So it was caused a sort of a... Dan O'Dowd is one of the old pipe makers and very, very good reed maker. You know, people relied on Dan a lot in Dublin because he was one of the few reed makers at the time. and they would... We'd had a sort of a musical soiree going there sometimes. And then we'd even go to the bog cutting turf because I like to be sort of working with some of the people there. And we'd go to the bog cutting turf, bringing donkeys, and Michelle would come up and Dan O'Dell would come up and all the musicians, and, you know, we'd all work together. And then we'd go to Doolin in the evening. And then I used to do some gigs in the roadside tavern a couple of years I did with Michelin playing the concertina, and he played the box as well, and I played the pipes. And I always remember one night we were playing nicely together because we knew each other's tunes really.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelin turned to me after he must have felt nice about the music, because he turned to me and he said to me, "Isn't it amazing," he said, "the sounds that come from bits of timber vibrating and bits of steel vibrating together."
His head
was inside in the workings of the pipes and the workings of the concertina. He was nice, he think outside the box.
It's very true.
Somebody asked him once, did he ever cut turf? He said, no, he said, I wouldn't. And that's why would you not cut turf? He says, because the bogs of Ireland are upside down. See, the good turf is on the bottom, you know. He reckoned if they were all up the right way, then he'd cut it, you know. So he had a very, very intriguing way of a mischievous sort of a player. And so I love that part of it too. It's not just about the notes. It's about the chats and the attitudes and, you know.
They were old characters.
They were. Yeah. They had just ways of working. All those older style. And then people like Brud Petty would come in the middle of the session and he'd do some of his recitations, and it would make for a wonderful night, really.
And what, so I mentioned in the introduction that you've done a huge amount of work in recording these people. You've done videos with Dick Grant, Pascal Brooks, like I've seen so many, and I'm sure a lot of people who listen to the podcast today will have seen some of these clips.
Yeah.
What was the, what got you started in this, like, who had the idea, and why did you do it?
I knew there was something special, you see, about those people, and I knew, having come from a place outside where those sorts of people didn't exist, it was like coming into a parts of Connemara where people were speaking Gaelic, and I knew people in Dublin who spoke Gaelic, in a club in Connemara in Harker Street. There were the academics who learned Irish. There would be some people from the Gaeltachts, but there'd be sort of people who were speaking the language as a sort of an add-on, you know, but their lives were in English. But you go to places like Carraroe or Osmuck or Lettermore, and the people lived in Irish. I went to a pub once in Spittle, and Breach Hughes had a pub. It was a music pub where Daidonan more or less started. And I was in there one day, and Breach said that the dog came in behind the counter. The dog, the sheepdog was wet, and he was starting to shake himself over the customers. And Breach shouted at him, and she said, "Go machu," in Irish. And the dog went out, and I realised that the dogs talked Irish as well.
Yes.
So it was more... And the reason I'm saying all this is when I came to Doolin, even though I was up in Dublin and people were playing music in the pubs, they weren't playing it in the same way. It wasn't part of the culture. Like when Nora Shannon used to come in with her apron on, covered in flour, she'd be making bread, she'd come into the pub, and all of a sudden she'd be set dancing with everybody else. So it was part of the life.
Would you say in the way you knew it in Dublin was maybe... not out of context, but the context was different.
It was different, yeah. It wasn't part of the people's lives. It was something they did as a sort of a outside of how they lived. It was an interest they had. But in Doolin, it was different. It was sort of, it was in the people's DNA, really. Mm-hmm. And even the people who weren't playing would be able to ask you for tunes they liked, or they'd be dancing. Most of them would, you know, be very good set dancers. Yeah.
If they didn't play, they would dance or sing or probably tell stories. Yeah.
Or they'd be able to, you know, lilt tunes because they'd have all the notes. So I knew it was something special. And what happened was myself and Dick Grant were in O'Connor's one night, and I think it was, we became a bit fixated on Paddy Kaluri because Paddy was very animated, is the word, I suppose, when he was playing. Not only did the bow move, but everything moved.
Yes, yes.
And his head moved and his body moved and he was putting every ounce of energy into it. And he had a sort of a demonic look on his face. He looked a little bit like Satan or something, satanic looking nearly, when he was playing. He was so taken with the music. And I said to Dick, we didn't have any movie cameras or that. And I said, Dick, wouldn't it be great to do a video of those lads now? And Dick said, Jesus, yeah. And that was the germ then. And I don't know which of us. I think we both of us started to say we'd go and see if we can find a cameraman, and we found Pascal. Because Pascal had no idea of what these lads were like. He was used to doing weddings and things, you know, where people would dress up and that. So we had to try and explain to him that this is sort of not the same. We're going to try and get these lads now to sit in front of a camera for the first time, nearly, and play tunes. And
yeah, I can imagine the challenge.
Yeah, it was, and it took a little bit of... And we didn't do it all in the pubs either. We sort of decided that we'd go into the houses where they played usually. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, like, even with Gussie Russell now was a little bit difficult. Gussie had a flute now that was in bad condition. So I had to get the flute from Gussie and do a nice bit of work on it and get it playing really well. and to try and talk him into sitting down and be photographed. He wasn't keen on it. He was very shy, you know.
Yeah.
And eventually what happened was we sat him down and Pascal did something. He hadn't got the camera switched on right. And after really working hard to get Cussie sitting down, Pascal said, "Oh, we'll have to do that again." "Stop," he said. "We have to do that again." And my heart sank because I thought, Cussie got up and he ran. He ran out in the field with his flute in his hand. And I said, "Cussie, come on back." He said, I won't." He said, "I won't, no." So I had to talk him back in and calm him down. And he sat down and we got him the second time. But just hit and miss, you know.
Yes.
But it was lovely times. And Paddy, you know, Paddy Mullins was in his house with a lovely day there. And great sport and very, very funny stories in between.
All these videos that you made, well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for making them, because for people like myself and a ton of others who were either not born or in other places in Ireland or in the world, we didn't have access to all this music, and to actually see it on film is very, very different. I feel privileged to be able to actually watch all, because there's hours of footage.
Hours of footage, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever counted how many hours.
I think
hours
about 13 total. Hours altogether.
Yeah. I mean, like, and you've actually posted a good few on your Facebook.
Yeah,
as
I do it every so often, yeah. When somebody asks for something, I pass it, put it on for everybody to see. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, my first meeting with, I must have forgot to mention, my first meeting with Paddy Caloury was, I was playing a tune one night, I don't know, but I didn't see Paddy coming in. And so I don't get distracted, I close my eyes when I'm playing. So I was playing with my eyes closed. I don't even know what tune it was. But when I stopped playing, there was this face in front of mine. It was Paddy's. And Paddy didn't know me very well. And I still remember what he said. "By God," he said, "you have the music. I love you. I love you." I got a bit of a shock because there was no personal distance involved, you know?
Yes, yes, yeah.
He just put his face right in next to me. And so that's my introduction to Paddy. And after recording Paddy and John in the house, Philip King, somehow or other, happened to see the video footage that we did of them. And he immediately became enthralled and drove down and asked them would they appear on the Bringing It All Back Home series, which they did. And it gave them great kudos, you know.
Yes.
And they got a very formal letter from John thanking me for the exposure. You know, it was lovely, you know, that they were sort of... Because nowadays, with this sort of, I don't know what, the sterility of broadcasting, it's only very, very good musicians who are technically perfect that appear on the airwaves. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it has to be like that. But they miss an awful lot, really.
Does it have to be
like
that?
Yeah, miss. You know, it's not all about just technical perfection.
It's like, you know, I love listening to albums that are not perfect. Like,
yeah.
You know, live recordings. There's that almost...
the odd squeak.
Gaming, like, "Oh, did you hear that?"
Yeah.
Make these great musician sounds.
We can pretend like the Navajo Indians, when they did these elaborate geometric weavings, that they always put in a little mistake purposely, because they didn't want to take over from God.
Yeah.
So we could say the same about the music.
And you know, you were talking about the Kiwis. I have to admit, I have a bit of a soft spot for, just from these videos that you've posted, like the way John speaks, especially, well, the way they both speak, but like, it's fascinating. Before we have more chats, would you like to play another tune maybe, or anything?
I'll play one of Michael's just to remember him. It's Slow Air, well, not that slow, and Poshti and Fionn.
Lovely.
It's a common enough song.
Great.
Thank you.
So nice. Lovely. Thank you, Eugene. I have heard Michael play this tune on recordings. Yeah,
one of his favorite ones. I think we played a duet on a recording at one stage, myself and him. We used to go up to Galway and recording studio up there, run by Sean Walsh, a very sort of easygoing place. He did quite a few recordings of Michael.
You've learned a good few tunes from Michael. Like, for Michael in particular.
Yeah.
Is it just because you played the whistle and you played the pipes too?
Yeah, I remember winter nights, especially when things were quiet, when Michael would come in. And I especially remember a lovely night where there was another man came in. I can't remember his name. He was from Ennis Diamond, an oldish man. And we happened to have, I don't know for what reason, we happened to have three sea whistles. And they started playing marches, and we played marches all night long. And wow. Ones you don't normally hear, you know. And it was one of those lovely nights, easy going, you know, just playing and swapping tunes and listening to little stories. Yeah, they were very precious times, really.
And what was, I imagine a lot of these nights were in people's houses, but also in the pub, especially O'Connor's, must have been a unique place among.
Yeah, I suppose Gussie's was like a bit like a country kitchen in a way, like everybody know each other and the banter would be there, and there'd be banter coming from behind the counter. Dolly was very quick with the repartee, and Gussie, of course, has a lovely dry sense of humour. So there'd be all sorts of stuff going on. Rory O'Connor was a bit of a trickster. He'd be always playing tricks on people. So there was all sorts of...
Rory, the King of Doolin, wasn't that his?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But he didn't play, did he?
Yeah. He did play the whistle, yeah.
He played the whistle.
He sang songs. Sang rude songs was a specialty. The crabfish was one of his favourite ones. But a poor woman that went to do her wee-wee in the middle of the night and got caught by a crab that was down in the pole. That was one of his favourite songs. You wouldn't hear that in the radio, like, you know?
No, you probably wouldn't.
So there was a sort of an alternative culture, I suppose, happening that normal people in their sitting rooms wouldn't hear.
You're probably right with the alternative culture. And I think Paul O'Carroll actually used those words as well. I think it's been the case in Dublin for a long, long time, even before that, with the... There was kind of a bohemian writers coming for a long time. I don't know what makes it something in the air or...
What happened, I think, was the early influences from outside in Doolin were from the Bloomsbury set in London. Augustus John, painters, friends of him, were friendly with the people from the Falls Hotel, the McNamara's. Henry V. McNamara was the landlord of the place. So they would come over here. And Henry V's son, Francis, had a place in Doolin. So it was like, I think that was in the 20s. And they came over. And there was bathing huts at the time on the beach. Michael talked about the bathing huts where people could dress, you know, and undress, going for swims. I presume they were in the Trawlahan. Dangerous place for swimming. But
yeah, you wouldn't swim there now. Yeah.
Must be there now. But they obviously were down there that time. And there was all sorts of antics going on. So they sort of paved the way for the generations afterwards that came in. And they were very accepted by the... There's a wonderful book by the natives. They just liked the idea of strangers coming in and adding to the place in a way, you know, with the bits of madness or whatever was going on. But there was a great book written by one of them. She was a daughter of Henry V. McNamara. Her name was Nicolette de Vasse. She married a Greek army officer or something. And I think it's available in the library. It's called Two Flamboyant Fathers.
Yeah, I believe it's even people can buy it on Amazon. I actually got it as a gift recently.
Oh, can you? Yeah, it's interesting.
I don't know in local bookshops now, because the one I got was a second-hand copy, but you can find them every now and then.
Yes,
it's really that. Because I suppose in a lot of remote places in Ireland, such as Doolin, the welcome for outside influence might not always be seen as keenly as it was here.
I think there's an Irish Gaelic saying that says "Anodis ana visintach." It's the rare thing that's wonderful. So to see somebody from a different culture, you know, it's wonderful for a while. Yeah. But then if you get too many of them, it becomes less wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a problem. Like I noticed in Mexico many, many years ago, and I was over 40 years ago, the Mexican economy south of the border, Tijuana, depended completely on the gringos. And then they didn't like them,
yeah.
But they depended on them. And I think tourism can get to that level as well, where you've become dependent, you know, financially on the tourism industry, but there's too many of them.
They
have it now
true.
With the traffic on the roads and the terrible yeah. accident and all that sort of thing. You know, just too many people.
Yeah, and how it influenced, actually, you know, we're talking about music, how you'd get told every day you play faster or play more like this or play more like that.
We had a little story in a school book when I was a kid about the goose that laid the golden egg. Do you remember that story? And everybody
yes.
wanted the goose then.
Yeah.
And they wanted the goose so badly that they killed them. Or the story that's to go with the seven streams up near Mullaghmore. The cow that gave so much milk, she just gave all the milk you wanted. But then some greedy person came with a sieve and milked the cow. And she'd fill any vessel, but he brought a sieve. And he milked the cow under the sieve, and the cow, he kept milking her, and she died.
Yeah.
So the same thing can happen, I think, with something like the tourism. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I've no idea what the answer is, but it's certainly important to be mindful of it.
Yeah, that's
for sure. Somehow I think there was something happened in Dublin where the balance was struck perfectly between being open to outside influence and how rich what was here already was. It just worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
Thanks again for recording so much of it because I really mean it. It's great to have all these recordings. Before I let you go, because we've been talking for a while already, but I'd love to hear a bit more about your adventures and your boat. We're just talking about it before we recorded how... I actually passed by your house in Kinvara and I just saw the boat being brought away.
Yeah.
So tell us about that a little bit.
I'll do as quickly as I can, I suppose. I was in Fanor for a number of years and I had a little boat there as well, but I always had a hankering for going to sea, and I moved up. I suppose people often ask me why I left such a beautiful place like Fanor, and it was twofold really, partly because I was a little bit like a savage, because the tour buses used to stop outside my place and looking in the windows and taking photographs. You know, I had to sort of dodge the tour buses. I became a bit of a spectacle, you know. I didn't want to, I didn't like it that much. And it's also so difficult in the summertime to try and travel anywhere with the tour buses on the road. So I decided to move to Kinvara. But I also decided to move to Kinvara because I wanted to build a boat. And it was a more... you know, it's closer to the sea and that sort of thing. So I did a bit of research and I decided to build a blue water vessel, one that I could go long distances in. And I bought some plans from a naval architect in Cornwall called Alan Pape, and ordered 3.5 tons of flat steel, and it arrived over in a big flatbed trailer from England. And I started building, and I was building the boat for close on 5 years, I suppose, from the time I laid down the first keel. The part of the keel is the bottom of the boat. I laid down the first sheet and cut the keel out. And 5 years later, I had her launched in Kinvara. And I spent about probably 5 years living on the boat. I rented out the house to give me income while I went away and travelled on the boat out to little exploratory trips first to the Aran Islands and then down to Dingle, and then the following year I went down to the north of Spain and travelled down the coast, Portugal and Canaries. And, you know, I came back a couple of times just, you know, to meet people and that sort of thing. But mostly I stayed away for 5 years, and I travelled across the Atlantic from the Cape Verde Islands to 2004. I did a solo transatlantic from little island in the north of the Cape Verde groups, Cabo Verde, off Senegal, across to a little island called Tobago in the, just not far, it's not just beside Venezuela, beside Trinidad. And that took 21 days and I did it solo. It was a lovely trip, really.
I love how you talk about this so casually. Like, it's, what an adventure. Like, I mean.
Well, it is an adventure, but it's an easy sail too, though, because
well, if I was to do it, I don't think I'd make it, so.
Well, you'd make it whether you liked it or not, because the trade winds are blown all the time anyway. Okay. So you get blown over, even if you don't, it may take you a bit longer, but.
I'm not sure I'd have the courage.
Yeah, well, it is a bit scary. Someone told me once that courage isn't the absence of fear, it's having the fear and doing it anyway. So,
yes.
You know, when I pulled up the anchor after being down in, what happened was I had a couple of people on the boat when I left the Canary Islands, and it's about 800 miles south of the Cape Verde. And the idea was we were all going to go across the Atlantic, but a row broke out between the two people who were two Germans. And anyway, to cut lots of long story short, when we get to Cape Verde, I couldn't get off the boat fast enough. So I was left by myself, really. And anyway, it suited me. I like to be alone a lot. And it would be difficult to get back up from the Cape Verde Islands because the prevailing winds are against you. It'd be a long, difficult beat to get back up to Ireland. So it's nearly easier to go across the Atlantic and come back. So that's what happened. And I had to do a lot of work on the boat because I got a couple of issues with a broken rudder and that sort of thing. And it was very difficult to get parts down there. So I spent nearly 2 months on this little island getting the boat ready. And then when you let go, you know, there's plenty of wind. It was usually people go across the Atlantic at about Christmas time when the trade winds are starting to get stronger. But I was about 2 months later than everybody else, as usual. And they were very strong when I left. So very big seas. And get that false sort of feeling, geez, there's no way back now, you know.
Yeah.
And it's going to take me 3 weeks. You know, I prided myself that I think Columbus did it in 19 days and I did it in 21. So, and he had a big crew of people. So I thought I did very well, really.
Oh, you did. But, well, and you, he didn't build his own boat, in fairness.
He didn't build his own boat, no. Yeah, no,
there
he
you
didn't,
go.
No. I forgot about that. Yeah, it was really exciting, though, you know, when you wake up in the morning and there'd be flying fish on the deck and you just put them in the pan and fry them up, and just like mackerel with big wings on. Like mackerel with big wings on. Wings are nearly a foot long, you know. But you pull the wings off and fry them up. It's best of food and best of company. And it was nice then when you're coming in towards the islands then. You feel like it's sort of a sense of achievement, I suppose. Or relief. I'm not sure
imagine.
Which.
Yeah, yeah. Both probably.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably enough of material to do a podcast solely about your trip, we'll leave it there for now.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Eugene, for taking the time to do this.
Okay, Charles.
I'd like to say, double thank you, because you've actually done this twice. We had a recording issue the first time, so thank you so much for coming back.
You're welcome. Are we going to play a tune together now?
Yeah, before I let you go, we'll play a couple of tunes.
Okay.
Nice. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you again so much for listening to the Tunes from Dublin podcast, and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss new episodes. It would be very helpful if you could tell your friends about the show too, share it on social media, and feel free to visit the Patreon page if you'd like to support. If you'd like to know more about the Tunes from Dublin project, you can check out the website and YouTube channel. You can also email me at tunesfromdublin@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Thanks again, and see you at the next episode.